science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Okay, kilograms. They've changed the weight of the kilo. Is that correct?
Well, sort
can
of.
That not even
yes,
happen?
Yes, no.
Is that allowed?
No, yes. Oh, so to really talk about this, we need to sort of delve back into 1790s France, which
okay, not too much.
Thrilled about.
Not too much delving, though.
Well, were we doing other things than fight the revolution?
Than having
back
a revolution
then?
And everything. Yeah, so it's all thanks okay. to the French Revolution that we have things like the kilogram and the meter and stuff
yeah,
like that.
Right.
And these units of measurement are called the SI system of units, the Système International, excuse my bad pronunciation.
International system.
Or indeed, yes, but they don't call it the IS, do they?
Nope. Perks of being French and having invented it.
Yeah, indeed, yes. So when we measure anything, we need to have units, obviously. And this SI system of units was a very, very good thing because there was a whole lot of really crazy units that were used many years before that. So what was it? A yard was the length of one of the king's shoulders to his fingertips or something like that. So mm-hmm. it was all sort of, you know, very
random.
Very random. And so the French put it on a good balanced keel by coming up with these units. And obviously when you've got a unit, you've got to have something that you measure everything relative to. So there's these seven SI units with which you can measure absolutely anything. And they are the units of mass, which is the kilogram, which is what we're going to be talking about. Length is the meter. Time is the second. Current is the ampere or ampere.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Luminous intensity or brightness is the candela. Temperature is the Kelvin, not the degree Celsius. And amount of substance is the mole, beloved of chemists. But each of these units is defined in particular ways. And the kilogram is defined by a piece of platinum iridium alloy that lives on the outskirts of Paris and has done so since 1889.
Okay.
And that is defined as weighing exactly 1 kilogram, 1.00000 kilograms. And all of the masses in the world are measured relative to this particular piece of right. platinum iridium alloy. And there's a kind of problem with that because this can change, okay? It's a physical piece of matter, mm-hmm. and as happens with all physical pieces of matter, they don't necessarily stay the same. Now, this is held in a triple locked thing and you know, under vacuum and all of this, but even so, it has been theorized anyway that this is gaining perhaps tens of micrograms every century.
It's gaining?
Yes, indeed.
I thought it would have been wasting away.
No. So it can absorb stuff from the air.
Right.
Okay, even though it's under a vacuum, no such thing as a perfect vacuum. So, you know, there'll be little bits of matter floating around in there and they can change the mass of this kilogram. So what we need is a definition of the kilogram that doesn't rely on a particular physical object. And so scientists have come up with this.
All right, here we go.
And on Friday, they're having this big meeting in Versailles on Friday where they're going to vote on redefining the kilogram in terms of a thing called Planck's constant.
What is that?
Yeah, I was just about to ask. What do we know about Planck's constant?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Okay, so there was this guy by the name of Max Planck. Now, you've heard of quantum, haven't you? Quantum is a common word.
Yes.
Okay, in common parlance, it's often used incorrectly, but we won't go there. But Planck was the first person to come along and say that the universe or energy or whatever you want to call it isn't continuous. It occurs in little bite sizes, or really, 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 really little bite sizes, essentially. So energy, for example, is not a continuous thing. Okay, it's emitted and it's absorbed in little chunks of energy, tiny little amounts that he called quanta. And that's where quantum comes from. And that's the start of this thing called quantum mechanics, which is where science went absolutely weird and bonkers and everything, and Newton was shown to be wrong, and et cetera, et cetera. And so in honor of him, who he won the Nobel Prize in physics in, I think, 1901, they have this thing called Planck's constant, which is related to these quanta, these tiny, tiny, tiny chunks of energy. And it's a really, really small number. It's 6 × 10⁻³⁴.
Okay.
Yeah. She said disinterestedly.
No, just trying to visualize
yeah,
it. But
me
you can't.
Too. I'm like, yeah, how well, do you even?
And that's the thing. You can't really visualize this. It's a really, really tiny number. But the important thing is it's a constant of nature. It's a constant of the universe. It never changes, okay? So unlike this physical object, this kilogram, whose mass can change, the value of Planck's constant doesn't change. It's a constant, like something like the speed of light, for example. The speed of light in a vacuum is absolutely constant. 2.998 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. There doesn't change.
There you go.
Okay?
Yeah. We all know that.
So, so it's the same with this. And what you can do is that you can have a very, very sensitive balance called a Kibble balance, which doesn't rely on a counterweight. Like you think of the, your classical scales, okay? You put a weight on one side and then you put a counterweight on the other and then you wait until it sort of balances out. This Kibble balance uses a weight, but it doesn't use a counterweight. It uses essentially an electromagnetic force to balance exactly the weight that's on the other pan, essentially, if you're thinking of it being like that. And electromagnetic force is related to the value of this Planck constant. Okay, so if we can get a really, really accurate value for the Planck constant, then we can measure the weight of anything really, really, really accurately, and we can use essentially this accurate value of Planck's constant in our redefinition now of what 1 kilogram actually means. Okay.
Okay.
Have I lost everybody?
No. So
let's go back to the point.
The point, yes. What was the point?
Well, are they changing the way that we measure, or that the base measurement?
Yeah, they're changing the reference point essentially. Yeah. Okay, and they're making it supposedly more accurate.
But we're still going to use kilograms.
We are still going to use kilograms. Now you go down to the shop and you buy, 2 kilos of bananas, or it's not going to affect you in the slightest. It's not going to affect really anybody in the slightest, except for all these sciencey, geeky type people who are in laboratories who really need to know this stuff really, really highly accurately because they're interested in sort of the fabric of the universe and everything. It makes a difference to them. Mm-hmm. It's going to make a tiny, tiny, tiny difference, but, it will make a difference. But the beauty of it is that now we've got away from, this is essentially the last unit that's defined by a physical object. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, essentially everything else now is defined in much more accurate terms than it originally was. Like, for example, when we had the meter originally, the good old French, they said that it was 1/10 millionth of the distance between the equator and the North Pole.
Ah.
Okay. That's not the most particularly accurate.
No.
it's a difficult kind of thing to measure as well. But that was the original definition of the meter. Now it's defined in terms of wavelengths of light.
Well, at least we tried.
Oh, no, I give the French full credit here. No, full credit. I'm, big fan,
But yeah, that was a bit far-fetched.
Unlike a certain president on the radio this morning and his tweets and shit and everything, giving the French a hard time. Anyway, sorry, okay. I shouldn't have brought him in.
Too much delving.
So there we go. Yes.
So there we go. But on the note of mass.
Yes.
Measuring the Earth's mass. How do we do this?
Indeed, yeah. And, two very closely related stories that it took you to sort of point out to me this morning anyway. So that's a really good question. How do you measure the mass of something really big when you can't put it on a set of scales? And obviously we'd love to know the mass of the Earth, and how do we actually do that? So one way of doing that, and this is sort of the classical way, if you will, is to use the theory of gravitation. And you can, from a famous gravitational equation, which anybody out there who has done high school physics will know, I'm sure, F equals GMM upon R squared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yes.
Where if you know the forces involved and you know one of the masses and you know the radius, then you can work out the other mass. So essentially you can work out the mass of the Earth by figuring out the force that it exerts on anything, really, okay, at the surface of the Earth, okay? And that's a relatively simple calculation to do, and it should give you a fairly decent value of the mass of the Earth. So that's the classical way of doing it. However, they've just discovered another way of doing this, and this is using little particles called neutrinos. Now, we've talked about neutrinos.
Yes, I remember that. I don't think you were there.
Excuse me.
Okay, I wasn't there.
We talked about neutrinos. We said that they'd figured out where these neutrinos actually came from, a particular galaxy or whatever And they could figure out where these came from. So neutrinos are rather weird subatomic particles. They're essentially got no mass, and they essentially pass pretty much through anything. They can travel right through anything. We're being bombarded right now by millions of neutrinos. They're all going straight through us and not doing anything.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we're being bombarded by all sorts of stuff. Oh, you do.
You
don't want to know. Yeah, okay. Yeah. I think Marcus was talking about sort of mobile phones and cancer, I think, last week. Yeah. I think the jury's still out on that. Anyway, so neutrinos can travel pretty much through anything. Now, very occasionally they get stopped. They hit an atom, they hit the nucleus of an atom, and they get stopped. And that doesn't happen very often, really, okay? So it's quite hard to detect neutrinos. However, they've got this thing at the South Pole called the Ice Cube Neutrino Detector. And what they can do is that they can look for neutrinos that are actually coming through the Earth.
Hmm.
Okay? So, for example, if you're at the South Pole and a neutrino travels straight through from the North Pole right through to the South Pole, it could be detected by these detectors that they've got buried in the ice about 1 or 2 kilometres deep down at the South Pole.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really, really quite a fancy bloody
thing. Very specific thing to build.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And so from the angle that neutrino comes, they can figure out where it's come from. Okay? So if basically it's coming at some, you know, a perpendicular angle, then they know that it's come straight through the Earth.
Right.
And what they can then do is figure out the density of the medium that it's actually come through. Now, other neutrinos are going to come at different angles. The one from the North Pole has had to go through the crust and the mantle and the core in order to get to the South Pole. Other ones might come from different angles, and they might just sort of graze the crust, or they might, you know, go through the crust, the mantle, etc., or a little bit of the core, etc., depending on what angle they've come from. And basically, by working out these angles, looking at these angles and figuring out how many neutrinos are actually getting through, then they can figure out the density of the stuff that they've been through. Okay, and if you know your density, you can get your mass, because density is just mass divided by volume. Okay, and that's kind of cool. So the whole thing is that the chances of a neutrino being detected or being stopped essentially are related to the density of the medium. Okay, mm-hmm. And knowing that relationship, they can then figure out the density of the Earth, and then knowing the volume, they can then figure out.
Yeah, and what can we do when we know the density of the Earth?
We can get the mass of the Earth, and we can say, well, we know what the mass of the Earth is.
Oh, there's no actual applications of this knowledge.
Oh, I'm sure that there probably are. I mean, when you're working out, sensitive sort of gravitational calculations, you're doing those sorts of things. Like when they put up spacecraft and stuff like that, they are getting sort of gravitational kicks by going close to planets or going close to moons or whatever. Right. And that gives them a gravitational kick. And in order to do those calculations really, really carefully, they've got to know these masses, you know, very, 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 with very high precision. So we now know that the mass of the Earth is 6 × 10⁴ kilograms.
Times 10 to the 24.
So that's 6 with 24 zeros after it, which takes a bit of time to write down.
Oh, I thought you were trying to do it later. 24 zeros.
Look at it later. Okay. That's
your pub quiz question. And the interesting thing is that value agrees very well with the value that's worked out by gravitation. So the classical value and this value, they agree, which is
brilliant.
Nice. Yeah.
Last story we're going to do very quickly.
Yes, indeed.
Plants growing with the help of music.
Yeah, well, this is
specific types of plants.
Yes,
you're
indeed
going to talk about, Alan.
Well, so 5 men were arrested in Alicante last week in Spain, south of Spain, and for having a hydroponics operation, growing dope indoors, etc. And they seized about 33 kilograms of dope and a couple of thousand plants. But the interesting thing was that they found that, you know, this was sort of a hands-off 24-hour operation. They were playing classical music to the plants the whole time, under the assumption that playing classical music would assist the growing of the plants. And I thought, my gosh, this sounds interesting. I must check the literature on this. Let's see if this is a thing. And the answer is, I don't think the definitive experiment's been done on this yet. It's seemingly a very, very popular science fair topic, okay? So the little kiddies will, you know, do their sorts of things, and they'll play music to the plants and have some plants with no music, etc. And I think it really needs to be tested under very, very careful scientific conditions. People have said, yes, they've done some experiments and they say that something to do with the vibrations in the plants, it aids
growth. We have talked about music before and its effect on growing things.
And, from what I can find, there really is not a lot that's particularly, well, that you would take at face value out there, let's say.
So people have sort of tried to look into it, but not in the most serious manner?
Well, I think the first thing you're going to need is an absolutely soundproof environment as your control, which, and I think what a lot of people have done is they've just sort of, you know, had a couple of, different rooms or something. They've got plants in one room, you know, supposedly in the quiet, and then you've got the music in the other one. But then you've got all the ambient noise. You've got all the, you know, all that other noise that's going around. So they're not in a perfectly dead noise environment. So it'd be kind of an interesting thing to do, I think. So, yeah.
Something to hear about in the future.
Yeah.
All right, brilliant.
Yeah.
Thank you, Alan.
Not a problem.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.
You'll see me next. Hang on. You might see me next week.
All right, we'll email about it. See you later. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, guys. See ya.
That was Dear Science.